The following program, The Kitchen Table Progressives, is sponsored by The Kitchen Table Progressives and to the extent applicable, their guests. The views and opinions expressed therein do not necessarily reflect those of NewsWeb Radio Company or its management.
Progressive, Paul Richardson here, inviting you to join us around the table for an hour of casual conversation on law, civics, and politics, driving the current issues, where the menu is progressive, and the table manners are unapologetically, well, liberal, if we have any manners at all. It's been an interesting week, so Trump secures the $175 million bond was cut from, what, $353 million in this campaign finance and hush money case. He got it from this some insurance company, some sleazy tease, fly-by-night insurance company. I got a feeling about these people are not. Okay, so they have $550 million in available capital, and they're going to put off 175% or $175 million to Trump's bond. That's like 31% of their available capital. I got a feeling these cats are not really an insurance company. Not in the sense that they pay claims. They're kind of more of a money laundering operation. Anyway, it's an interesting development. But, you know, we're going to go forward. And the question is, will the campaign finance trial actually go forward on April 15th? Will it really start, or will some federal judge save the day somehow for Trump? I mean, even if it was a state court trial. We'll see. Anyway, on the program this week, is the MAGA movement an extremist movement, do you think? I mean, or are we the liberals? The liberals are the ones who extreme with our, you know, anything goes libertine views. You know, we can say what we could be, whatever gender we want, whatever race we want. We kill babies after they're born 10 days, right? We're the extremists, aren't we? That's what they're trying to say. I mean, that's what the other side would say. So Trump loves autocracy. He loves, Bolsonaro and Erdogan and Viktor Orban. And, of course, he loves Putin. That's sort of autocratic rule. Is that what goes along with extremism? We're going to... What qualifies a view as being extreme? Isn't the other side of the issue just as far removed? We'll explore this. We'll explore these questions with our guests this week. From the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Global Project, a Global Extremism.org project, we have with us Heidi Byrick and Wendy Villa. Ladies, welcome to Kitchen Table Progressive, and thanks for being here. First of all, did I get the names right? Okay.
It's Wendy Vi, but that's okay.
Wendy Vi. Okay. Wendy yeah. Vi. And
you got mine right.
Okay. Well, 50%, I almost passed, you know. Well, it depends on, you know, if it's graded on a curve. But tell us a little bit about the global extremism .org, I guess I'm calling it a project. What was the impetus to get this started? What is it? Let's start with that. What's the goal here and the objective with that?
Wendy, do you want this one or you want me to take it?
Sure. No, we can both take it. The Global Project Against Hate and Extremism is the name of our organization. Heidi and I started it about 4 years ago after having worked at the Southern Poverty Law Center for a number of years. We understood that the extremist problem that we're facing, the far-right extremist problem, was not something that could only be addressed in the United States. We had to take into account what was happening in other parts of the world and how that was impacting the United States, and also what the United States activity was or what, rather what impact it was having in other countries. So we started about 4 years ago, and I think one thing that we can say is that everywhere that there is extremist activity, as and we can get into a definition later, there's always connections to the United States.
Sure. And maybe, I mean, you say you started this program 4 years ago, but when you talk about the United States influence really propping up or perpetuating extremism, and I'm thinking about Central America now, we could go back 40 years, couldn't we?
Well, we could go back a very long way.
Time, but, yes.
Yeah, but when it comes to far-right extremism, the issue just wasn't being, you know, people were not paying attention. We weren't addressing it. We were not making the connections like we should have.
Right. Well, so, okay, let's hold on to that point as a because as we go through the questions here, so the United States has been involved in promoting, let's say, extremism for a very long time, and in the Middle East, too, as a matter of fact. I think there's much to be said about the fact that the United States really props up. We know in Iran that the United States, you know, basically mounted a coup in 1953 to remove Mohammad Mossadegh from, you know, it was a democratically elected leader of Iran, and reinstall a monarch that had been deposed 50 years before, not 50 years, but certainly 30 some years before. The Pahlavi dynasty was out after World War One. So then, of course, he was a brutal dictator. We propped up his Saddam Hussein. So we'll get into that. Because I want to figure out what is the purpose of this and how does it function for us. But if we could just get kind of into some basic questions, because I think, as I was saying in my kind of tongue-in-cheek intro, you know, it's like it's as far from point A to point B as it is from point B to point A. It's a long way to Tipperary, but it's the same distance back. So what makes one view more extremist than another? What qualifies as extremist? So let's get with the how do we define extremism? Let's start with that so we can get on the same page. How could we do that?
Well, I'll take that one. Great. You know, we look at a particular type of extremism that is far right extremism. There are other kinds of extremism for sure, but that's the focus that we have. And the kinds of movements that we are concerned about are those that are bigoted or dehumanize various populations. So you've got your neo-Nazis and your white supremacists, those kinds of folks who obviously demonize, you know, basically anybody who's not white and oftentimes male. There are also movements like Christian nationalists that target the LGBTQ population and women's rights. And there's a spectrum here between those groups that engage in violence to those that are closer to the mainstream and more involved in politics, sort of closer to the MAGA movement, for example, today. And the reason we focus on far-right extremism is twofold. One, it is where most domestic terrorism and violence is coming from nowadays, political violence. And secondly, because we have seen over the last several years, certainly since Trump got in, that our entire political system has been pulled towards the far right. So things that used to be considered to be on the fringe or at least unacceptable dinner talk are now heard regularly. Things like the Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which is this white supremacist idea that there's a plot to import people of color into the United States, largely through immigration, to change our culture. So that's what our focus is on. There are certainly other forms of extremism, Islamic extremism, for example, but many others. But we look at this particular part of the world, and we do it because we're concerned about what it's doing to our politics and the levels of violence connected to it.
Sure. Okay. So, so it's a political look at political far-right political extremism in the West, in the United States, certainly. But yeah, as you know, when you mentioned that about it's been gradually being tugged to the right. I kind of look at it as, and in terms of progressivism, it might work as well. I kind of look at it as, to use kind of a football analogy, if I may, it's like field position. It's the more it gets dragged down to that side of the field, the more we have to play in their end of the field. It's like we almost are always playing on defense if they make these. When we have, a president like Donald Trump, who makes some progress, then we have to, our field position changes. When we have a very divided Congress, for instance, as we do now, the Congress is sort of playing in the middle of the field. That's, between the 40s, near the 50-yard line. And I think the Republican House doesn't know how to do that very well. They don't know how to negotiate a few votes at a time. I think they're a complete disaster. But so let's go on to this idea of what differentiates extremism from moderation? And who's to say which is which, and it, which is, virtue and which is vice? How do we know them? How can we because they'll say, as I said in my introduction, it's kind of the I know you are, but what am I? You're the one who's extreme. You liberals are extreme. What are they doing that makes them extreme that, for instance, that we're not doing? And I think I know part of the answer, but I'm going to let you go ahead with it.
Well, I'll start at it and let Wendy pick up. I think anything involved with racism and hatred towards certain populations is certainly extremist. Unfortunately, using your analogy, the Republicans have pulled us down to their side of the field. So things that used to be completely unacceptable in normal politics, like saying immigrants are poisoning the blood of Americans,
yes. Yeah.
has now been normalized. And whereas it used to be. So that's one aspect of this. Wendy, you want to add to that?
No, I of course I agree. We often compare it, to the cordon sanitaire. So how do you decide what is extreme and what isn't? And if you sort of look at most of the people that are not on the extreme edges, they adhere to the cordon sanitaire, meaning that line that by which nobody is going to cross because it's unacceptable. But and so it is the same analogy. You're moving that line constantly now. And one of the things that we do, our mission is to help move that line back. How do you determine what is extreme and what is? Well, I mean, it's like Heidi said. I mean, we don't think it takes a lot of debate to say that blatant racism, blatant bigotry, and associated violence, and the policies that go along with it are in the extreme, because generally people believe we want a solid, multicultural, flourishing democracy.
Sure.
Now,
okay, let me underline some things here. I think the first thing is that politically, things that would have never been tolerated in the past, and I've used this analogy before, is where I can remember the 1984 presidential campaign when the top candidate, Gary Hart, there was a photograph of him with a woman by the name of Donna Rice. It was a setup on a boat of her sitting close to him or on his lap or something, and it absolutely destroyed his campaign overnight. And we have a guy who's running for office for president again, who says that it's okay to grab women by the genitals, and he has been found in a sexual assault case in which he's now paying for sexual assault and defamation, what he's been ordered to pay almost $90 million, well, $91 million with the bond. And yet it's almost as though, as you say, we have to be defensive about this. That's how far the ball's been moved down the field. The other thing I would underline is the associated violence that comes with it. That's another of what I'm hearing from you is associated violence. I mean, you can have views, whatever you want, but the associated violence, and we have seen that. Am I getting that right? Am I underlining, highlighting the right sentences here?
Well, yes, I think that's right. And we see things, what is acceptable changes over time. That's obvious. Mm-hmm. But when we think about sort of the basics and what is, you know, just simply what is right, and it, not what is right by this extreme versus extremist versus that extreme. It's just generally what people believe is right. It's not hard to try to, you know, work within that space. And these folks that we deal with don't, either through very, as you said, violence or through radical policy changes.
Right. So this, again, a radical policy changes. So this is going to be not only a viewpoint, an attitude that is now going to be incorporated into government. So extremism, we can say, extreme views are not only associated with violence. Essentially, this is force, coerciveness. Government's going to coerce people to have to do what one side determines is the right thing to do. And we've heard all about the book banning, sex and gender mores, or that have actually come on the one hand into acceptance, such as same-sex marriage, and now we have this backlash of hatred and violence, and we've seen violence. So, okay, that's I think we're getting a good point.
Which is virtue.
Let me respond to Barry Goldwater's. Let's get this. I wanted to respond to. I was thinking about Barry Goldwater's famous quote, and let's talk about this just a little bit. He said, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice, and moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue." So he seems to be. Is this just wordplay? Is he just, thinking that it's okay to be extreme sometimes? I guess what he's saying is that, so in other words, yeah, if someone's threatening my life, am I being an extremist by defending myself, even if I end up having to hurt them or even kill them? Is he misusing the concept of extremism here?
Well, I think what he's trying to say is in defense of liberty, right? His view, a positive thing. And what we have here is people whose extremism exists specifically to strip various populations of their liberties.
Yes.
Whether that is, you know, same-sex marriage or equity policies or humane immigration policy or women's rights. That's what's happening here, right? This isn't extremism in defense of anything good. This is something that's literally trying to dismantle a human rights protecting multiracial democracy. Nothing to be defended. And that's what people need to understand about this movement, that it's got our democracy in the crosshairs, and it certainly has civil rights in the crosshairs.
Right. And yet we have a judiciary, a federal judiciary, which I think is out of control, stacked with judges who seem to resonate with some of this, up all the way up to the Supreme Court, I would suggest. Is that part of, have we seen this in other extremist, political extremist movements around the world? Have we seen that same, this same kind of thing that's, do we have, is this the canary in the coal mine? Do we have is there a telltale here that our judiciary, and of course the judge, I think down in Florida, the fact that Donald Trump appointed the judge, and he has the power, the president has the power to appoint federal judges, even in the district where he lives. But when it comes to the point where that particular individual who may have once been president has to face charges in a federal district, I mean, really, should that judge be not automatically recused? This is something that just, to me, that's maybe a job for Congress to come up with a whole section and lists of things that require automatic recusal. I cannot see how it's, you know, we go to this point where we, let's give Judge Cannon a chance and see how she does. But once you go down that road, then if you say, no, she's not being a neutral arbiter of the law, then we look like the ones who are being the complainy whinies because it's not going our way. Why don't we just not go down that road? Let's have some safeguards, just as in, by the way, in Georgia, the judge in Georgia said that because there may be a personal relationship between District Attorney Fani Willis and one of her team members, Nathan Wade, that one of them would have to leave the team, even though the Trump team did not prove their case that there was a conflict of interest. One of the Willis or Wade will have to leave the team because it looks bad. Well, everything that Judge Cannon does looks bad. Yet we don't hear that. We don't have the plea for that. Are the courts helping move this extremist MAGA movement forward? Or am I being whiny and complaining?
No, I think getting the judiciary in order is one of the hallmarks of the backsliding of democracy. Your first question was, do we see this in other countries? And the answer is yes. You see sort of all of these same steps. If you look at Hungary, the judiciary, the way that the voting districts are gerrymandered in such a way is that Orban and his party will never lose. The way that there's only like one free press outlet left. So these are just examples of the road to authoritarianism. And in the United States, it has been the extreme right's position that they had to get the courts in order to make all the changes that they want to make, and they're getting them. And I think that another thing that has happened is that there's sort of a set of guidelines. They're not laws, but the judiciary issues them. I think you might remember that when it came up that the Supreme Court didn't have its own set of ethics laws,
right, sure.
Or not laws, but rules. And that was sort of very astonishing. But all the other courts do. But again, they're guidelines, not laws. And the extreme right has contacted all of these judges and said, these are just guidelines. You don't have to follow them. So when you have a case before you, you are free to use your own judgment as you were appointed to do. Right. So there's no mechanism by which to remove Judge Cannon, just as there's no mechanism to get or to encourage Justice Thomas to recuse himself.
Right. And yet all of us who go to all kinds of, we have in just about every profession, code of ethics is probably the first thing that you're handed on the job when you show up to a new job. And I don't care what field you're in, education. That's where I come from is education. And, because of things that have happened over the past 30 or 40 years with regard to student-teacher relationships, this the idea that, that you wouldn't recuse yourself in certain situations or that you would – that there would be that anybody could think that the that there was anything wrong with a relationship or that something was going on. And by the way, in terms of what teachers are by law expected to do, if a teacher sees a student that and even suspects that there may be abuse, that bruise on your arm, I don't care if you say you got hit with a baseball. If I even suspect that more looks like you or somebody grabbed you really hard, I am by law required to call the authorities. And yet we at the highest levels of our judiciary, it's not really a requirement. It's a suggestion. I think that's something we could fix too. Let's get to this idea. What kinds of structures are used to carry out the functions and implement the purposes of extremism? What are the functions? What are the functions and purposes? What do they get out of it? What do they get out of being a controlling extremist and controlling, what do they want from this? What does the MAGA movement want? What do the extremists want? What's the end game?
Well, I would argue what they want is to control the federal government and the state governments forever. I mean, there's talk in the MAGA movement of getting rid of the amendment that bars a president from only serving two terms. And frankly, more than 100 conservative organizations have laid out an explicit plan called Project 2025 about the world that they want to see if a conservative is elected. And this is one in which, all kinds of diversity initiatives are ended. There's no longer an endangered species list or environmental efforts. The Department of Justice and the FBI will specifically be politicized to go after mm-hmm. their enemies, where the civil service will no longer be nonpartisan. It'll be stacked mm-hmm. with allies. I mean, this is a plan to go straight to authoritarianism. Wendy mm-hmm. mentioned a little while ago Orban in Hungary, and it looks like they want us to end up where Hungary is, which the EU calls an electoral autocracy. Mm-hmm. That's the plan here, right? To rule forever and to rule with a really harsh anti-civil rights, anti-democratic agenda if they, you know, get enough power.
So is the concern that our Constitution does not have sufficient safeguards to prevent the implementation or of a 2025 kind of project? Or I mean, certainly our courts are suspect. They might be, when it comes to them, they'll find just about any reason to, you know, they know how to tinker with words. So is that what you're saying? If they found, I've said this before, you know, every piece of software has bugs in it, and the Constitution has bugs in it. So I have has the MAGA. They have the MAGA movement. They have a lot of good lawyers. Have they found the bugs? And they if they found a way, because there used to be the New American Century Project that was the Dick Cheney, you know, the 2000. Is this like the New American Century Project 2.0? And but even on steroids, so to speak. And are there not sufficient constitutional safeguards to that we can rely on? And should how concerned should people be? Should be afraid, very afraid?
Well, I mean, we hope that our institutions can hold. But the thing is there are a lot of things that happen that are norms and not laws, like the Department of Justice right. being independent, like the president not pressuring the head of the FBI. These are norms. And if you control the presidency, meaning the administration, there's a lot that you can do through your cabinet positions by fiat, like with immigration. A president can pretty much dictate what that looks like. So, you know, under the Constitution, a lot of how our democracy functions is kind of like those judicial rules that Wendy was talking about. They're sort of agreed on values or sets of mores. And if you want to smash them, you can. Wendy, I'm sorry. I think you were saying something.
No, I mean, I was basically going to say that. I think I would just add that because you asked about whether or not the Constitution had the pieces that we need to maintain our democracy. I mean, of course, I would argue that it does. Some might argue that it doesn't because the judges are interpreting it the way that they want to, or the way, you know, from their perspective. So that's how you get something like a Mifepristone being going to the Supreme Court, the Mifepristone being the abortion drug
sure.
that's prescribed by doctors, and questioning whether or not the FDA had the right to approve it. So that goes to the Supreme Court. And so we will find out, does the Constitution have what is required to protect an agency like the FDA and all the people in this country who take prescription medicines, right?
Right. And of course, we have – yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's like – I mean, but that goes back to getting the judiciary, having a having it – constructed in such a way that even if you lose at one level of court, you go to the next level and you have a chance to win there. And these folks who are using the courts, these organizations like Alliance Defending Freedom, Heritage Foundation, groups that Heidi was talking about when she said the 100 groups supporting this Project 2025, they have used the courts very, very effectively. And right. one of the ways they've done it is through the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is legislation. Right. They've just managed to twist it.
That's what they do. Right. Well, that's because so when you talk about, you know, does the FDA have the power, you know, to had the power to approve Mifepristone? And we're seeing one of the cases And I had just actually kind of put two and two together as you were talking about mifepristone, is that we have the challenge to the Chevron rule coming up in the Supreme Court. They could, really, the FDA should have the power to have approved mifepristone, but if the court rewrites their position on the Chevron rule and says, well, you know, they have turned that on its head several times. This goes upside down and over again, like they did in the FDA versus Brown and Williamson Tobacco in 1996, which is about the most mind-boggling twist, a turn on words that I've ever read. But now they're going to be set to perhaps change it. So yeah, it lets the corporations not only do anything they want to, but it also says in mifepristone, no, FDA did not have the power to approve that. They'll have it every which way they want to. That's kind of the way I feel about the court system. Let's move on to this idea. Is extremism single-minded, but with sort of multiple manifestations and religious, sociocultural, economic, political, gender role, sex-specific? Are these just examples of different kinds of extremism with different goals and objectives? Is extremism, does it have a single kind of mindset? Is that just control?
Well, I think once again you have to think about what kind of extremism you're talking about. On far-right extremism, I'd agree with you. If I was a radical anarchist, I would have a different perspective, right?
Okay. All right.
So as far as far-right extremism goes, they have a particular vision of society that doesn't look like the one that we live in. It's not democratic. It's not diverse. It favors what they call the natural family or the traditional family over same-sex and other kinds of relationships. This is the world that they want to construct. In many ways, they want to go back to a sort of an imagined, you know, past, American past. And they're going to do everything they can to force us down that direction. It's got a strong strain of white supremacy, too, right? This really rabid anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim sentiments that reside there. But of course, different types of extremism have different goals. In this case, you're going to have a much stronger hold over institutions, if you can, through the administration, to force these changes and roll back things like, you know, the decision Obergefell, right? Or to get where you got with Roe. And we should remember stare decisis doesn't seem to matter much anymore for the Supreme Court either.
Right. Right. Let's, if you don't mind, ladies, let's get to a couple of our callers. Jim, our friend Jim from Chicago is up first. Jim, how are you doing?
Good evening. Channel 7 was, their big headline tonight was Trump raises $50 million from billionaires down in Florida. Now, he says, I'll promise I'll cut your taxes for sure. Now, that's a group of maybe 50 or 100 billionaires. So it seems to me that the 99% of the country is running against about 200 billionaires in the United States. They bought the Supreme Court. Sheldon Whitehouse has pointed out already how much each of these Republicans and robes they had to pay for, with $20 million for Comey, $30 million for Kavanaugh. These are all price tags. And these people are bound and determined to buy the future of the United States. And it's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. In the meantime, they don't mention one word on the news of how our economy is the envy of the world. We have the lowest inflation in the world. We have the highest number of people employed. Our salaries are overtaking inflation. And yet these billionaires are bound and determined to buy our democracy.
Yeah, okay. Let's get a response from our guest. So is it just the autocracy, the old aristocracy or whatever it is? Is that what we're dealing with? Is that really what's behind extremism? Is money? That's kind of the old standby. It's money. Like I said, I think we all have different points of view, and people People would say that I'm an extremist. I know the right wing would say that I'm an extremist because, yes, I do believe that a woman has a right to terminate a pregnancy right up into the stage of delivery. If she's showing, like, super, gestational hypertension and she's delivering and her blood pressure is 225 over 150 and the doctor thinks we need to stop this, yes, she has a right to – and I would say that by both the Fifth and 14th Amendment that they have the right to life, liberty – and pursuit of happiness, and your life, if your life is threatened because of a biological, something that's going on, a biological event, a medical event, you have a right to change it. And by the way, I think I'm on solid ground. I've read that all abortions at the times of the colonial times were late term, because that's when pregnancies become different and dangerous and deadly. Difficult, dangerous, and deadly. And they did. They did very late term abortions. I was just reading in a book called America's First Daughter. It was about Thomas Jefferson's first daughter, Martha. And the first part of the book talks about a late term abortion and how all that got scandalized to be infanticide. But so is it all just the right wing and a few billionaires that are setting this up, trying to create a culture war for us? How would you respond to what Jim said?
Well, I would say two things. There are two things behind the extremism that we're talking about. One is economic concerns, right? Some billionaires are going to do whatever is required for them to continue to be billionaires. Yeah. And so you have that. But then the other is an ideological perspective. And we see that. Heidi and I work a lot on the effects of Christian nationalism. Mm-hmm. And so it's the idea is that this country needs to be remade in its original image, which is a Christian nation, you know, sort of inspired by God. And therefore, every societal decision should be based on a Christianity point of view. Yeah. So what you have, I think, is a mutual I can't think of the right word, but you have the sort of the hardcore economic and then the Christian ideologists who are willing to work together and suspend their moral codes in order to achieve what they ultimately want, which is, as Heidi described. And if that means putting Trump in office, if that means getting certain judges on the bench, then that is what they're going to do.
Right. They don't really care that Trump doesn't know the right end of a Bible. If he, as a matter of fact, he really doesn't. Okay, let's get another caller in here. Dave from Hoffman's Estates is there? Is Dave still there? Dave, hey, how you doing?
Yep. Good afternoon, Paul. Yes. I got 2 points for you. First one, earlier in the week, I saw on CNN or whatever that said, Nikki Haley is still drawing in uncommitted voters. It got me to thinking, why doesn't President Biden do what FDR did with Wendell Willkie after he had beaten him and offer her some type of a position? Mm-hmm. Where, because Wendell Willkie had made two or so more wartime foreign trips as a President Roosevelt's informal envoy, and not a leader of the Republican Party, gave FDR his full support. And in fact, Wilkie and FDR had discussed the possibility of forming a liberal political party after the war. But fortunately, Wilkie died in October of 1944 before the idea could bear fruit. And could you imagine if he still would have had Henry Wallace as his vice president? Would be much more liberal, I believe, than we are now. But I'll close out with this one for you. Did you see the story? Earlier in the week too, where the Republicans wanted to name, that Dulles Airport after Trump. Well, I see where Democratic Representative Jerry Connolly, Jared Moskowitz and John Garamandi sponsoring a bill now to rename the Miami Federal Correctional Institution in Florida to Donald J. Trump Correctional Institution.
So maybe, you mean when he goes to stay there? You mean?
Yeah, Trump, you know, the place, and then maybe they wanted dollars in that too. That was the one airport that Trump said that George Washington and them guys were going to storm during the Revolutionary War.
yeah, right.
You remember that? Yeah. Anyway. Well, let me clear off. I'll listen to you guys on the side, so, you know, in case somebody else wants to get through.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
All right, be well.
Okay, always great to hear from you, Dave. I'm in favor of renaming Dulles Airport, but I still think that Vice President Dulles was head and shoulders above Donald Trump, no matter what Donald Trump is, no matter how high his elevator shoes are. I'm sorry. I just, no. Donald Trump should be memorialized by nothing. Let's get into the idea of defending against extremism. Is there a single global extremist movement? In other words, something that these people, as we've talked about, you know, Orban and Erdogan and Bolsonaro and the guy in, what's it, Peru. Is there a kind of a, or is this, is it just there's, extremism happens to be worldwide, is it? Or are they all trying to do the same thing?
Different forms.
There certainly is a network of these people. Uh-huh. You know, CPAC, this event that happens every year in Washington, has for years this conservative conference. It used to be a very much a domestic thing. And now CPAC holds events in Brazil. You know, Bolsonaro's son is sort of the host. Mm-hmm. Hungary, many other places. There's almost like a far-right populist international that has developed over recent years. And the playbook is pretty much the same in every case. Demonize certain populations. For Bolsonaro, it was indigenous folks, women, LGBTQ. Build your base by sowing fear about these populations. I mean, it's the same playbook for Orban. Frankly, it's the same playbook that Modi uses in India. And it is a new thing. We didn't have these kinds of strong far-right movements for decades because we sort of learned our lesson during World War II. And that lesson is now being forgotten, and we're seeing these political developments.
Well, that really is – I mean, my era is – of women's rights was the 70s. And when I was in college in the 70s, the women that were my friends were just absolutely totally dedicated to women's rights and would protect the Roe decision with their lives. Their daughters and granddaughters seemed not as concerned. And I think, frankly, that's what's, it's gotten away, the Dobbs decision. I think there was just kind of a, I don't know, women fell asleep to this or took it for granted. But, you know, in Casey and Webster in 1989, and Sandra Day O'Connor wrote in both Webster and Casey, and she wrote that, you know, a generation of women have grown up in Casey have grown up with the expectation of choice, and a judiciary is not predictable, a jurisprudence that is not predictable is there's no liberty in a judiciary that is in doubt. That's what she said. There is no liberty in a judiciary that is in doubt. And I think that's quite right, but it seems to have slipped away. Maybe there's a political backlash. Hopefully, it seems to have been working. At least women seem to be more concerned about it.
Tenets of extremism, and how can we recognize when such?
Let's talk about defending against extremism. What do we need to do to make people aware and, you know, accomplish the goals of the globalextremism.org project, so to speak. I keep calling it that. What do we need to do? What do we need to, as we're closing out here, coming up, you know, towards the end of our discussion in a few minutes, the next 10, 15 minutes, what should we do to be ready and be aware?
Well, I think the first thing is that we as a nation should not take our institutions for granted. We cannot. It's just, as you were saying, that there are generations of young women or women that have known nothing but choice. And it's sort of hard to imagine not having it unless it's right in front of you, right? And so I think we have clearly taken our democracy for granted, taken our systems for granted, assumed that our institutions will hold. And I think that people saw January 6th. They saw everything that happened leading up to January 6th. And now we can say, oh, but wait, the democracy held. Everything held. It's all fine. Well, it did, but that does not mean it will the next time. And we shouldn't just assume that it will. And so how do we defend against extremism? One, I mean, like what Heidi and I try to do is we try to expose these elements because they are very good at going under the radar. We try to educate folks. We, you know, it's as simple a thing as being aware, reading the newspaper, but not the same one or not just one, right? Get your news from different places. Participate in the democratic process. Express your opinion. I know these things all seem very basic, but these are the things that keep a democracy together. Heidi, do you want to add that? Oh, sorry. Excuse me.
No. Go ahead. Let me just get this in there, since we have a few minutes, about 10 minutes, about 8 minutes left, maybe. And so I don't want to rush. This part is so. Let's let the listeners know, where can they go as they're listening now? They can hit some of these websites. They can go to globalextremism.org, right?
Yes, please.
Yeah, and you can read. Yeah, please do. And there's a whole feature about Project 2025 there that lays out every aspect of this nefarious sort of plot. We also are on Twitter at Global Extremism and on LinkedIn.
Okay, so you can go, everybody, to www.globalextremism.org. That's where you can start to see what's going on, what Heidi and Wendy are working on. And then I want people to be able to, as you suggest here in the last few minutes, other things to read. And how to defend against... here's a question I wanted to ask.
Against extremist agendas.
How do we help others who are being influenced by extremist agendas, maybe younger people, and maybe even people who've already kind of bought into... I mean, we always have a family member, and I have more than a few, who buy into this. How do we approach them, you know, without getting into, an argument or doing damage and destroying the relationship? So is there an approach that we can take?
Well, Paul, I'm from Alabama, and so we have to navigate this all the time. But it's not just people from the Deep South. It is, as you say, all over the country.
It is.
And I think that what you bring up is extremely important, in that people have lost friends, they have lost communities, because it feels like the politics is touching every part of our lives in a way that it didn't used to. We didn't used to have this polarization. And all I can say is that if you can have a very reasoned and respectful debate about any one issue. And I would say, do that. Don't try to debate whether or not Trump or Biden is a good or a bad person. Talk about the issues and what it is that we're trying to achieve as a nation. And it's going to be, in my view, a lot easier to get to an understanding that way when you talk about the issue and what it really means to people. I don't know if that works. I mean, when you're talking, the Thanksgiving dinner table is a very real thing, and you don't, and people don't want to cause dissension, so people say nothing, or they say something because they can't take it another minute. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult situation. Heidi, how would you suggest that people deal with it?
Well, I mean, look, with polarization, sometimes if you come on too hard confronting someone over their beliefs, psychological studies show that they get more entrenched. And it's hard to talk to somebody who's highly polarized. There is, however, in the U.S., a movable middle that you can speak to about these issues and that does want to dig into them and is will be against extremism, like we've been talking about, if they know about it, if they know it threatens our democracy, it threatens civil rights, and so on. And so I think those conversations there are really, really important.
Yeah. And to sort out, I suppose, because a lot of extremism, or, I mean, without doing a Yogi Bear-ism, you know, 90% of extremism is half mental or whatever. It's something like that. It's wrapped up in, like you say, but not only political, but politics has kind of incorporated a religious elements since probably the 1970s, and cultural. I always think that the Republicans and the MAGAs, they're the party of the social and cultural grievances. That's all they want to talk about. They don't really talk about policies of any kind. They're just talking about what they think is right or morally right. And there's so in that regard, there's really no. It's very difficult to sort of debate with them or even discuss because they're on the position of no, that's morally wrong, and so no one will compromise on their morals. Although they do, they don't realize they do, but. They do. Nobody's morally absolute because they would find themselves in a pickle in a hurry. But that's the heart that I find to be difficult is that it's all so kind of tangled up, almost inextricably. You have political issues, which are policies. Then we have cultural issues and then religious issues. And then those all get mixed up about what's right and what's wrong, and I won't agree with you, and I won't compromise my values or standards or whatever. And that makes – as long as we have politicians who are able to do that, and it seems to be something that they can do, create strife and stridency, then they can get people upset. It's really a matter of – I think if you're in the minority, which I really believe that the Republicans are, that their goal is to – create strife, and that makes people upset, and that you only need a few people. I mean, especially if you've been in education, you don't. You know, if you have a classroom through 30 people, it only takes two or three to disrupt the whole classroom. So you don't need a majority of people to get disrupted. What we need is the majority of people to turn around and say, "No, we're not going to have it this way. We want to continue to run a civil culture." Yeah.
Well, I was going to add, we don't just need the majority, you know, we need people to say, to take a stand, but who we really need to take a stand are, you know, sort of the more mainstream Republicans. Yeah. When you say it's a minority, it's a minority of a minority that is actually wielding all this power right now.
That's right. Will they? It's amazing that. The Mitt Romney outrage meter only just goes up so far, and then he's disturbed or he's disappointed, but he never really says this is wrong. I've never heard Mitt Romney make a speech like like a Kennedy speech. Anyway, thank you very much, ladies. This has been a fascinating conversation. We are out of time for this hour and this edition of Kitchen Table Progressive on extremism, right-wing political extremism and global extremism is something to be concerned about. And keep in mind, go to globalextremism.org and learn more. Once again, join us again next Sunday night for another edition of Kitchen Table Progressive right here on AM 820 WCPT, Chicago's Progressive Talk, where facts matter, at heartlandsignal.com. We'll see you next time.